This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Thanks for listening. I'm Susan Franzen, your host for today, proud to bring you celebrations from around Story County. For starters, this has been a very special week for Nevada. Just a week ago, we learned Nevada has been designated a Main Street Iowa town. Later in the program, we'll learn what that means. This announcement comes just as they're getting ready for Lincoln Highway Days out at the Story County Fairgrounds. We're fortunate that our first guest today, Steve Skaggs, is a member of the board of the Nevada Chamber of Commerce, who was a leading member of both the Nevada Main Street Iowa Committee and the Lincoln Highway Days Committee. And the best luck for us here at KHOI is that in spite of all that intense work, he could still make time to talk with us. Hi, Steve.
Well, good morning, Susan. I wouldn't miss it for the world.
Well, we're so happy that you're here. Was I right? Are you a lead member on both? Or you're chair of one of them, aren't you?
I am the chairman of the Main Street Nevada Committee. And I have been on the board for Lincoln Highway Days for about 5 years now.
From what I heard on your podcast, would you like to say just a little about the podcast?
Yeah, that's great. Our mayor in Nevada, Brett Barker, is part of a terrific group here in Nevada called Nevada Nice, and they do a podcast every week about different events in the community. And the last couple of weeks, the rodeo and Lincoln Highway Days have been featured there. So you can find that on Facebook, if you look that up, and look up Nevada Nice.
Nevada Nice.
I love
that Facebook. I guess my first question is, was it a very long and difficult process to make the application?
Yes, it was. Main Street Iowa is part of Main Street America, and it's a program for economic development and historical preservation. Basically revitalizing downtowns in cities of all different sizes throughout Iowa and the nation. We're actually the 54th community in Iowa to be accepted into Main Street Iowa. So it is difficult. It's a several month process. It actually took us about 6 months to go through the entire application process, as well as a live presentation to the Main Street Iowa Advisory Committee, who makes the final decision on who gets in or not. We actually put a little different spin on it this year. We took our city council to the presentation and made a actual official city council meeting at the presentation to the advisory council to show them how committed our city was to this project. It was pretty fun.
Why did you wait as long as you did? Because I know both Story City and Ames. I was on the committee for Ames, so that's how come I know it's how difficult it is.
We were
rejected the first time.
Yes, and we are very fortunate that we got in the first time around. And I'll tell you, Nevada has been looking into this since 1987, we found during the process. The program only started in Iowa in 1985. So we've really been kind of toying around with the idea for quite some time. We've really never been able to put together the right collaboration in the community between the city, between all the various civic groups, citizens, the businesses, both on down in the downtown area and outside that. And this time, the magic happened. We were able to put everything together. We got everybody on board. We had financial support. We had lots of volunteer hours put into the application process. And everybody is really excited about the changes that this can bring to Nevada.
And that's the next question. What are the changes that you anticipate?
Well, Nevada is in a really interesting and exciting period right now, where we have attracted a significant amount of new jobs to Nevada. Some of our major employers have been doing expansions. We have Verbio coming online with the purchase of the previous DuPont ethanol plant. So there's a lot of people that potentially may be coming to Nevada to live and work. So we really see that Main Street Nevada can help create some additional housing for these folks, possibly above some of the downtown businesses and in the buildings in our downtown. Urban style living is a big thing right now, and people really like to live downtown where the action is. So we've been looking at converting some of the upper stories to living space. We want to bring more services, more restaurants, more things into town to help attract these people to live and stay in Nevada. So we're going to help out with that, as well as the city is doing a streetscape project where they are basically tearing up the entire downtown district to put in new infrastructure, new sewer lines, that sort of thing. And the businesses downtown will be affected by that, and we're hoping to help them through that process. And we can do that through making sure we're promoting their businesses, making sure that there's adequate signage, people know where they can park to get to the businesses that you may not be able to drive up to the front door right now. So we'll be able to help through the streetscape as well. And then there's, Main Street has lots of different things where there's business owners in downtown Nevada that are interested in working on the facades of their buildings, making them look new again, more historically appropriate. So there's a lot of interest in this project, and it is really exciting to get it finally kicked off.
Well, I imagine that just the cooperation that was required to apply gave you a jump start on this.
It is pretty remarkable, and cooperation is a great word for that, because it just does require contribution and effort from so many different entities in the community. And I would just I'd love to thank all of the different people involved, all of our businesses and civic and city organizations and private citizens who have really stepped up this time and said, we want to preserve Nevada. We're proud of Nevada. We want to bring more people to Nevada and help it grow.
Well, is this just a coincidence that the award of the designation came exactly at the time that you're going to have the Lincoln Highway Days? Or?
Well, I think you could say it's fortunate or unfortunate for some of us folks who are on both committees. But Lincoln Highway Days is in its, I think, 36th year. It's a great community festival we have. We have it this time of August every year. So it's coming up this weekend, and we have actually transformed this event as well. This year, the theme for Lincoln Highway Days is Back to the Good Old Days, and we've taken Lincoln Highway Days back to the good old days by moving the event back down to the fairgrounds, the Story County Fairgrounds, where it was for many years, to pair up with the rodeo, which is in its second year this year. So we think that these two events are, a great complement to each other. We are doing a lot of things to expand Lincoln Highway Days this year and make it really special.
I guess you have some transportation problems, though, when you move it down to the fairgrounds. Is that right?
Well, you do. We don't have as much parking down there. So we're actually have set up the fairground shuttle. So between 11 and 5, you can get a ride from various places throughout Nevada: Central Elementary, the Story County Administration Building, Nevada High School, the Almaco parking lot. You can park your car at any of those places. The shuttle will come by and pick you up about every 15 minutes or so and take you right to the fairgrounds, drop you off, and then be on the last bus by 5 to get back to your car. So we can alleviate some of the parking issues that way.
Do you usually have quite a few out-of-town visitors for Lincoln Highway Days?
You know what? We do. We have a significant amount of people that come from the surrounding communities. It's just a great old-time small-town carnival feeling to it, So it's a good way to get away. Maybe if you didn't make it to the state fair and you're craving some fair-type food and want to ride some rides, come on down.
Well, of course, you had the county fair there not so long ago.
Yes, we did. We did. We don't have a carnival as part of that, so this is kind of the next piece of everything that goes on down there.
And I guess your animals are mostly the ones brought in by the rodeo, right?
Yes, that's right. That's right. Exactly. This time it's mostly horses.
So what are some of the high points of this year's Lincoln Highway Days?
Well, we're actually kicking it off tomorrow night with a community barbecue at State Bank and Trust in downtown Nevada. Friday night, we've got some entertainment going on downtown. The Talent Factory and George's Pizza both have have events going on downtown. Great entertainment there. Saturday, we're really excited this year. There's a military convoy that has been traveling across the United States on the Lincoln Highway. It's a to honor the 1919 military convoy that actually President Eisenhower was part of back when he was in the military. So they actually are going to be 50 military vehicles that will be at Central Elementary School in the parking lot for viewing, and then they'll be participating in our Lincoln Highway Days parade at 10 a.m. We have a Lincoln Highway Dash at 9 a.m. That's a walk-run event, so come on and run. I think this year is going to be cool because you actually get to finish right before the parade, and all the people waiting for the parade will get to cheer you on. You know, it'll just be like you're in the Olympics or something. firefighters are having their hog roast at lunchtime. We have quite a few food trucks, food vendors, and craft vendors down at the fairgrounds. All kinds of things going on there. The crafts, jewelry, Tupperware, furniture, scooters, bake sale, you know, all that good stuff that you find at the craft fairs, as well as the food. You know, we've got Hawaiian ice cream. If you've ever been to Sweet Treats and Jewel, those guys do a nice job. Ice cream there. Our own pint-size ice cream, the tiniest ice cream truck you'll ever see, will be down at the fairgrounds. We've got barbecue, pie, street tacos, all sorts of yummy things down there. For lunch, we're having the carnival, mechanical rides, and inflatable things for the kids at the fairgrounds, as well as some free games down there. The Baptist Church puts that on every year. We'll have some antique tractors and cars down there as well to commemorate the Lincoln Highway part of this. We're having a beanbag toss tournament, a fundraiser for the high school that's always very popular. Free entertainment, Skunk River Jazz Band. I don't know if you've heard those guys, but they are terrific. They'll be at the fairgrounds in the Sheep Barn at 12 p.m. We have a guy who actually is a dead ringer for Ulysses S. Grant, who will be at the fairgrounds at 1 p.m. Todd Apple at 2, Main Street Dance Studios at 3, and that's the Martial Arts at 4. I know I'm just going on and on here, but we've got a lot going on. Kids tractor pulls at 11:30. Those are hilarious if you've ever seen that. The Nevada Public Library is doing some bingo at 3 to 4 p.m. Rodeo's at 6:30 p.m. that evening, Saturday evening. And then from 12 p.m. to midnight, the Nevada JCs will have a beer garden featuring the Punching Pandas. Not real Punching Pandas, but the band, the Punching Pandas, will be there that evening as well. And then there is also a collectibles furniture-type show in our extension building adjacent to the fairgrounds. And Farm Grounds Coffee, I think, will be there as well. So, as you can hear, we got a lot of stuff going on down there on Saturday.
You sure do. Now, what's the time again for the dance in the evening?
That will start, I believe, about 9 o'clock, but the actual beer garden is open from noon to midnight.
Oh, I see. I couldn't understand the time that you said.
Yep.
So, but the music is in the evening.
The music is in the evening after the rodeo.
Right.
Yep.
Right. And then in connection with the rodeo, I heard something called a boot shuffle?
The rodeo, yeah. I think it's a fun event. Basically, the kids throw a shoe off, and they go run and get it, and then they race back. It's really, they do some great things with the kids for the rodeo.
Last week I went to the Maxwell Old Settler Days.
Yes.
And one of the things that I was really surprised at is they had a rodeo. And I believe when I talked to Mark Olson, who was the part of the rodeo committee, it's the same company that does this. But because I went down to Maxwell, and of course Maxwell is under 1,000.
Yes.
It's a small community, and
yes,
I was amazed they had a rodeo. But I was also interested in their parade. I haven't been to a small town parade for many years. We promote a lot of them, but I don't usually get to see them.
Yes, right.
Well, I saw this one, and what struck me about it was that it was very different from what I was used to, say, in the Scandinavian Days parade.
Okay.
But where you have lots of different floats. And they had mostly vehicles. They had a lot of fire trucks, which I thought was a nice way. They, of course, have volunteer fire department to honor their other volunteer fire departments that come and help them.
So, you'll find the same thing at the Lincoln Highway Days Parade. We do have a lot of the surrounding fire departments participate in the parade, and we love that that collaboration between the different departments, the volunteer fire departments like we have in Nevada. So that's great to see. Yeah, like I said, we'll have these military vehicles. This convoy will be in it this year. We always have antique tractors, cars, local civic groups, lots of kids. So it is just it's a fun, old-fashioned community pride parade. You know, it's really great, and it lasts about an hour. And if you have small children, they will get all the candy they can carry.
Well, that's
a guarantee.
That was what struck me about the Maxwell Parade. I arrived about 15 minutes early, and not only was there not a parking place in Maxwell, but the street was lined.
Yeah.
And I thought, why are all the but they'd already started, kids come up and tell a joke and get some candy. and Paul said, oh yeah, you have to throw candy. That's the main
works,
feature
right.
of the parade.
Yeah, you've got to get your good spot to get the maximum amount of candy.
Okay. Well, congratulations. It sounds like a really wonderful, day you're going to have, or I guess a couple days, right?
Yes. Actually starts, the first events start tomorrow night.
Oh, really? Thursday?
Yeah, on Thursday, our community barbecue at State Bank.
Okay. Well, so I hope a lot of people hear this and find it. It sounds like it's going to be a very, very lively event.
Yes, it will. Please come take a look this year if you haven't been for a while. This event will be one to remember.
Okay. Well, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Susan. Appreciate everything you do.
Thank you.
Yep, take care.
That was Steve Skaggs telling us about Lincoln Highway Days coming up. Last year, Nevada reporter Tammy Kuhn recorded her impressions of her first rodeo, which is also the first rodeo they'd had for a while, and I'd like to play her report to give a sense of the excitement.
The rodeo on August 25th in Nevada, Iowa was my first rodeo. It was part of the Lincoln Highway Days. It was 90 degrees with high humidity as thousands of people passed the risers. There were hundreds of children sitting on the ground in front of the risers behind the steel fence. It was the final event of the year, last chance for the athlete riders to earn points on the pro tour to qualify for the televised finals in a few weeks. So there were lots of people there locally as well, riding with professional riders too. Wright Family Farms is a big rodeo outfit from Iowa that provides all the cattle for roping and the steers that they ride and all of that kind of thing. And I think they do that all around the country, too. So I didn't know anything about rodeos when I went there, but I learned that they basically, to me, seem to have two teams, the animals kind of versus the riders. Now, I'm not sure those are professional rodeo terms. Animals kind of earn points, and the riders win money if they complete their event. For example, how long they stay bareback bull riding. Then there's saddleback bull riding, calf roping, bucking broncos. There's team calf roping and barrel chasing. It's all really exciting. It was within these events that the drama of the rodeo kind of played out, which kind of made me, the phrase was going through my mind saying, this is America. We don't run from our bulls, we ride them. And that was kind of a point of patriotic frenzy for me. One of the events, you have to actually rope the calf, bring it to a standstill, get off the horse, turn the calf over. Physically, you have to lift this calf and then tie its legs together, both in the front and the back. And then you have to get back on your horse, and the calf has to stay still. It doesn't hurt the calf. In some cases, that calf got up again, and then you don't get any points, so you don't make any money. You could travel all this way from anywhere and you go home with nothing if that calf gets up. So it was definitely a little piece of Wild West Americana that came to Nevada, Iowa. It was a very patriotic event because we stood up and recognized veterans. They did a special tribute for them. And there were people from all walks of life there. There were people with Harley Davidson shirts and farm families were helping run the event right alongside the cattlemen. So it was just an exciting group of people that were gathered together to see a really fun event.
Another great one.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and I am your host for today, Susan Franzen. The inspiration for my next story comes from the Story City Herald, which had a front page story about KHOI's 7th birthday celebration, with a great color picture of KHOI station manager Ursula Rudenberg and assistant manager Preston Burris standing under our colorful 2019 mural. Of course, it mentioned the important role Story City played at the station, as you may notice if you are a regular listener. Our mandatory hourly station identification is KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames. That's because Story City is our address of license, and our tower is near Story City, although our studios are in Ames. As I read through the Story City Herald, I read Steve Lekwa's column, which I really liked. It was mentioning that the Iowa National Heritage Foundation is celebrating its 40th anniversary. And in that story, I also learned that some of my favorite local spots benefited from the foundation, including Doolittle Prairie, McFarland Park, Munn Woods, and the Dick Jordan Family Wildlife Center. There was a new park that I'd been following in local papers as well, and that's Dakin's Lake near Zaring. Since it's new, I thought it deserved a road trip and an introduction from someone at the foundation. I was fortunate that yesterday was a lovely day to drive the half hour from Ames to Dakin's Lake. And today, Lisa Hine, Senior Director for Conservation Programs at the Iowa National Heritage Foundation, can be here with us in the studio. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, good morning.
Oh, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And I noticed that a couple of the directors of the INF have been from Story County Conservation Board. Is that true for you as well?
Well, our current director, Joe McGovern, used to work for Story County Conservation, and our former president, Mark Ackleson, also worked for Story County Conservation many, many years ago. And I'm a resident of Story County, but I have not worked at Story County Conservation.
But you are conservation director, so what does that mean?
Well, my position is senior director for conservation programs, and I've been with the foundation actually for over 30 years now. And so my position has evolved. It includes helping families and landowners work with land protection, working with communities to help to do trail projects, primarily Rails to Trails. So Heart of Iowa Nature Trail was a project that I worked on many, many years ago. And now I have other staff that I work with to coordinate our volunteer program, do our Eastern Iowa outreach, as well as continue helping wherever possible with trails and greenway projects. So it's a little bit of a mixture, and plus some grant writing and helping get projects funded. So you get there, you know, when you're there 30 years, you kind of do a little bit of everything, and you just keep piling things on, I guess.
Well, I guess that the outside funding is very necessary, right?
Oh, absolutely, yes. We're a private nonprofit land conservation organization, and we are privately funded through memberships and donations. And so that's how, yeah, that's how we work.
Oh, well, besides Dakin's Lake, which we'll talk about a little later, mm-hmm. are there any current projects or if there are there any projects outside Story County that you'd like to let our listeners know about?
Yes. The foundation has done projects all across Iowa. We've been in every county except for three. And our job really is to help counties and communities with projects that maybe are going to take a little bit more time. And so we can step in and help facilitate land protection, land acquisition, and over time that will become public property. That's kind of a typical project. But we also work with families and landowners who really want to do land protection privately. So again, we do those projects all over Iowa, and those are generally in the form of what's called a conservation easement. So we've done quite a few of those. But getting back to your question of just maybe outside of Story County, we've worked certainly with Marshall County, Marshall and Hardin. We're helping with the Iowa River Trail. This is a 30-mile rails-to-trails conversion. Follows along a lot of the Iowa part of the Iowa River. Beautiful corridor. It's getting pieces done. A little bit's done in Marshalltown. A little bit's being done in Steamboat Rock. They're trying to do a loop between Steamboat Rock and Eldora up through Pine Lake State Park. Eventually, the two ends will get connected. It might be a few years. In Boone County, Iowa Wildlife Center. If you haven't had Marlene Ehrsman on to talk with you, I would highly recommend it. Great organization. So we helped them with the land that they own over there. And they're putting up a facility for wildlife rehab, and restoration. And they're doing a lot of restoration work. That's just outside of Ledges. So those are a couple of examples.
Well, since you're mentioning rails to trails, I recall that there was some problem with a trail, and there probably often is the same problem of one landowner who simply doesn't want to sell.
Well,
or to sell or give permission or an easement or anything. They don't want that bad element in the coming across their land.
Quote unquote. That can happen, but with the rails to trails, technically those rail lines don't get abandoned. They are used, they're preserved under the National Trail System Act. And so if there's a railroad that needs to be reactivated, that corridor remains intact rather than having the railroad try to go back and piece it back together again. So the transportation use becomes public biking and walking.
Oh, so it doesn't belong to private landowners?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't get abandoned. It's technically, it's an intact corridor still.
So this, you don't have that problem. Do you have other problems, though, with landowners who don't want to have your trails coming through their nearby to their property? Or?
Yes, and usually it's an issue of not really understanding what's involved. There's always concerns about property value loss, liability, maybe loss of privacy, and all of those issues can be addressed. We know that property values either remain the same or actually increase. Liability is, it's like having, if you had a sidewalk or a road in front of your house, if somebody's trespassing, they're trespassing. And in Iowa also, we have the recreational use statute that encourages people to get out on private land with permission to hunt and fish, and then the landowner's liability is minimized. So there are, those are concerns, but they can be addressed. And, you know, on anything, there might be one person that gives the whole system a bad reputation. But if you look at who's using trails, it's families, it's kids with their parents. I worked on the High Trestle Trail many years ago in protecting that corridor and helping the communities raise funds and get grants to convert it to a trail. I cannot tell you the joy that I received from being out there before it was even built and talking to a gentleman who lives near Madrid. And he would talk about how he'd bring his grandson out there every day to see the development of the trail, and they'd get out and walk on the sections that were completed. And, you know, you really can't put a price tag on that. And we build so many places for our cars these days. We just don't provide space for people to get out and bike and walk, as well as providing space for wildlife and habitat. All of those things are very important. And, yes, there does need to be, you know, some balance and things like that. But,
And is there any relationship between what you do and the CRP?
No, not really.
No. Nobody decides to change their
That's with a federal program, with the Natural Resources Conservation Service, NRCS. Uh-huh. They manage CRP. That's all federal.
It's financed federally, so it doesn't.
Yes,
no
and it's
overlap.
On private, and it's on private land, and
right.
Usually it's a 10 or 15 year program where landowners will give part of their land to rest for a day or 10 years.
Yes.
You know, I just think of
specifically. Are there any parks or areas in Boone County?
Well, I mentioned the Iowa Wildlife Center. We don't really have a whole lot going on right now. We have some conservation easements on some land, and that's private land in Boone County. There's a project, the Boone County Trails Initiative is working on their project going from starting at Madrid, trying to go north. And so they've got a section that they're working on to Swede Point Park so that people can go to camp and stay at the park and then go visit the trail.
So now the Dakins Lake project, I've been reading about in the paper because there's been a lot of dredging, right?
So Dakins Lake, yes, was an existing county park, and it was really one small kind of pond area that was used for fishing, and they had some campsites around there. And Story County really decided that they needed to enlarge the lake, but the Dakins family was really the impetus behind enlarging the area. So we helped work with the Dakins family that really wanted to see some additional protection out there. Story County had a vision for building a second lake and using the first lake as a detention, sort of a siltation basin. And we've added another 65 acres. Story County's put tremendous energy into building more campgrounds, putting in a shelter, encouraging the fishing, you know, putting in some fishing docks and things like that. So it's really quite an amazing resource. If you get out there, it's not very often that you can see clear water in Iowa, but if you get out on Dakins Lake, it's truly amazing to be able to see almost all the way to the bottom of the pond, and it's really wonderful to be able to see clean water in Iowa.
Yeah, and I read that you were stocking that lake also.
Well, Story County is, yes. And the folks in Ziering, the residents in the city of Ziering, it's a tremendous asset to their community because it brings more people into town. It's right on the edge of town. And so they are, they put some more funds into bringing in larger fish so that the fishing could start earlier. And so our role really was to work with the family to get the land acquired and protected. They gave a bargain sale to see that it could happen, and then worked with Story County Conservation as they got their grant funding and other funding sources lined up. The family, you know, when we work with families, they have strong ties to the land. It might have been in their family for many generations, and they really want to see that it be protected and others can enjoy it. But when they've made their decision and they're ready to go, they want to move fast. And so that's where Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation can step in and help facilitate and hold those properties until the public agency is, you know, gets their funding in order, which can take several years.
That park was really a surprise to me. And one of the things I enjoy about the road trips we take for Local Talk is that I learn things that I couldn't have believed. And that park is a surprise from beginning to end. There are some obviously very expensive there's a new shelter house, mm-hmm. and then there's a new restroom, mm-hmm. and, of course, the camping, the electrical sites, and mm-hmm. so forth. Who paid for that?
Well, you'd have to ask Story County, but I'm sure Story County Conservation, and they probably got some outside grants to help with that as well. So we all pay for it as citizens of Iowa and Story County, and that's usually how those things get
okay,
paid
so
for.
That's not part of the work of the Natural Heritage Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
No. Well, I'd also like to put in a plug for the primitive campground, which I think mm-hmm. is the old campground.
Yes.
Because the new one is lovely. All the buildings are lovely. They have lots of facilities. But the trees are tiny.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one of the reviews, they were, you know, this is excellent. And the one said, this will be excellent in 20 years when the trees grow. But we went around to the original, which is now the primitive campground, which has gorgeous oak trees, beautiful, beautiful camping in the woods.
Yeah.
It has just two portable toilets, but it doesn't, you know, no other facilities. But if for anybody who likes just camping, it's gorgeous.
Yeah. Well, what did they say? The best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The second best time is today.
Yeah.
And it, and what you describe is, it tells you how important these natural areas are to us as people that enjoy the outdoors or, and even the wildlife that's there without humans. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you for keeping that going.
And just give me a question and I'll talk for a while. There's a lot to say. There's so much going on, and Iowans really care about the outdoors. So we're happy to be a part of it and proud to be partnering with Story County on so many different things.
Well, thank you for coming in.
You're
and maybe
welcome.
I hope we'll have things to talk about in the future. Lisa.
Absolutely, anytime.
Thank you. And we need a little transition music. People are in. You've been listening to KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Susan Franzen, and I'm also one of the KHOI reporters who has been working with our new political reporter, Lily Bolke, who KHOI is hosting as she prepares her stories for Pacifica Radio and Public News Service. Her presence at KHOI enables us to cover many more candidates' events than would otherwise be possible. And as I've listened to more interviews from candidates, however, I've started to wonder what KHOI can do that isn't replicating the Des Moines Register or getting snippets of the many live streams from different candidate forums. I can't speak for other reporters, but my feeling is that Iowa is the perfect place to have a caucus of ideas, not only to determine which candidates may represent the largest number of ideas that we like, but which ideas are worth examining or challenging. One of the amazing things that is happening in this caucus year is that there are serious discussions of issues that have been neglected in past campaigns. For example, a comparison of approaches to gun reform, which was a forum that Lily covered completely, and I was able to bring in a one-hour compilation for Heart of Iowa last week, or prison reform, or Native American issues, which Lily is covered on Monday, and above all, on climate change, which wasn't even mentioned 4 years ago. In fact, in a question at a fundraiser, we asked a candidate for Congress to answer a question on climate change, and he flat out refused. Since many of these issues have a science component, I have invited Sam Wormley as a guest to help me think about them. Sam Wormley, who our listeners probably know by this time, is one of the co-hosts of Science Bites.
Well, thank you, Susan. I'm part of a science discussion group, and I regularly pass on articles about climate and other science onto those people. And some of those wind up being on the radio station here as part of Science Bites. I wanted to give you a quick background, the big picture. The big picture is that the Earth gets its primary source of energy from the sun. In the daytime, the sunlight is absorbed by the oceans and the rocks and the buildings and everything. And at night, a lot of it radiates back out into space. If it all radiated back out into space, we'd be a frozen snowball. But some of the gases in the atmosphere act like a greenhouse. And they are water and carbon dioxide and methane and a few other things. And there's a balance that is in place that allows the Earth to warm up to comfortable temperatures that life propagates in. And this sometimes the Earth gets hotter and sometimes the Earth gets colder. And if this change happens slow enough, the life that exists on the planet adapts and changes with the increasing temperature or the decreasing temperature. We're in a new situation because of the Industrial Revolution. Human activity has increased the concentration of these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and we're now rapidly warming. And that's what people hear in the news and read in the newspapers and so on. They call it global warming or climate change or whatever. And that is not necessarily bad, but if it changes quickly, then life really doesn't have a chance to adapt. The IPCC, which is the UN organization called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, issued a report in mid-August saying that they really talked about land use in this report, and they're basically saying our current industrial model for agriculture is not sustainable and really needs to change and change rapidly. That's pretty upsetting. And the candidates running for president are trying to grapple with this information and what can they tell voters that might help or not help the situation.
Well, that was why I brought you in, to help me to figure out how we can ask some questions. I guess, actually, one of the things that I have heard a lot more in this whole cycle is people doing what they call bird dog candidates. For example, the ACLU has trains people to go out and ask questions and be filmed. And they have their, you know, the four areas that they want to have people ask questions about. And I know that people concerned with climate are asking questions. But the questions that are raised by this last report, the criticism, to put it mildly, of industrial agriculture is going to be very, very difficult to come to grips with in any way. Do you have any suggestions about how we can ask questions or look for policies?
10 years ago, or even longer, at least the scientific community knew that there were problems with the changing climate, changing concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and the ramifications of that. Had we acted way back then, we might have been able to have incremental steps to make changes that would move us in the right direction. We now find ourselves in a not good situation where we are entrenched in the lifestyle that we have, the use of fossil fuels for transportation and heating and so on. Our whole society is built on using this model as a way to live. And yet we've now come up to the point where the rate of increase of the temperature of the earth is increasing fast enough that we really only have two options. Do nothing and just let it run its course, or try to be in control of our climate, which would basically totally wreck the way that we live. So it's not a good scenario, and I don't want to alarm the listeners. I'm just trying to say this is one of the things that the report is saying, that we basically have to change our agricultural practices in the next 3 years, and I just don't think that's going to happen.
So that's not what candidates want to deal with either, of course.
And, of course, the candidates want to be elected, and they have to appeal to the voters, and the voters don't want to hear gloom and doom. They've got to have some hope, and we've all got to have hope. And I like what Irv Kloss says. Irv Kloss says that even if we are losing ground in trying to get a hold of control of the climate, all of the things that we do to try really make our lives better. They make our communities better. They make our state better. They help us improve the conditions that we currently live in.
That is certainly a very positive way to look at a bad situation.
And it is. And it's absolutely true. And a lot of the things that we're trying to do to mitigate the changing climate actually can reduce our costs and enhance our lives.
Yes, and particularly, I guess, this would be true for agriculture, because a lot of the things that are implicit in what this report says fit into, for example, the many advocacy groups that we occasionally interview here, like Mighty Earth, which basically says, grow food, not fuel.
When we first settled in Iowa, and I'm talking about humans first settled in Iowa and plowed up the prairie.
I guess you mean the first European settlers.
The organic matter, the living things that were down in the soil, went down 8, 10, even 12 feet. And because of all that life in the soil we call healthy soil, was able to absorb large amounts of water. It was able to hold water in times of drought, and it provided the plants with all the nutrients they needed, and the plants that happened to evolve to live in this climate, live in this area, enriched that soil and kept it alive and healthy. When we started tilling the soil, plowing it, and disking it and so on, what we did was we destroyed a lot of that organic matter that was in the soil, releasing carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas, in the process. And unfortunately, our goal these days as farmers is to make a living and be able to minimize our expenses and maximize our yields. In order to do that, we're actually destroying the soil.
But one of the things that you're hearing quite a bit now, though, is about looking at the soil as a carbon sink and whether that could really absorb enough carbon to make a huge difference, considering how much we're producing with the use of oil. Why, still, the soil would be better.
The soil would be better if you didn't till it, if you used no-till operations. The soil eventually starts to retain some of that organic matter. And if you use cover crops when your main crop is not being harvested, you're actually putting nutrients back into the soil, and you're increasing the life the further down in that soil. So if we could migrate somehow to what we would call probably organic farming and not till the soil, it eventually regains some of its health. That's the goal.
We have a guest next week who is going to be expanding on that, and so we'll be ready.
Okay.
Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Susan.
standing on these mountains and plains, far away from the rolling ocean, still my dry land heart can say, I've been sailing all my life now, never harbor or port have I known. The wide universe is the ocean I travel, and the earth is my blue boat home. Sun, my sail, and moon, my rudder, as I ply the starry sea, leaning over the edge in wonder, casting questions into the deep, drifting here with my ship's companions, all we kindred pilgrim souls, making our way by the lights of the heavens in our beautiful blue boat home. Thanks to the waves upholding me, hail the great winds urging me on. Greet the infinite sea before me, sing the sky my sailor's song. I was born upon the fathoms, never harbor or port have I known. Wide universe is the ocean I travel, and the earth is my blue boat home. The wide universe is the ocean I travel, and the earth is my blue
been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Susan Franzen, your host for today. Other voices you heard were Steve Skaggs, Lisa Hine, and Sam Warmley. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. That's khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Paul Hertz. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Cherry Pink, played by High Society Big Band from their album High Society Big Band. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website at khoifm.org. Or come into the station and look around and see what it's about and meet some of the people who work here. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.